Okay, folks, let's make a start. So, it's Memento Week, so naturally Vincent has got to bring the DVD with him.
No, that's deliberate.
Ah! Why was it deliberate?
Because after here I've got to hightail it to somewhere out in the country. I didn't want to carry it with me.
Some of us have more than one job.
Yeah, very true. Some of us have more than one room in a motel. Okay, memento time, and now I'm going to ask you folks to be very, very honest. My bet is that even though this is very bad, there might be one or two who still haven't seen the film, and if there are, you can really help me out here. So, can I take a show of hands, anyone brave enough to own up to the fact they haven't actually yet seen Memento even once? Great. Anyone else? Okay, right. Now, nobody tell her anything in the next couple of minutes. So I'm going to do a tiny little exercise here with the start of the film. So let's play.
Thank you. in your end in October. It's a key. It feels like maybe this is the first time we can get that. Perhaps you've been there for a week, 3 months.
Okay, so once again with our neophyte. So now, what's happening? Or what's happened? Or what have you learned? backwards. What on earth is going on? Have you got any idea what's going on?
Well, the game is going to start. It's not going to start at the end. It's going to be back to like the start of the story.
Good guess. Good guess. But of course, what that means and the kind of situation of uncertainty that one is placed in is that one, in a certain sense, never knows what's going to happen next. One, in a certain sense, never has any idea what's going to happen next, because it's all the thing that happens before. Right? So you don't have any memory of it. You're sort of working backwards towards it. Now, the question I want to ask at this point is, how do you make a film? How can one make a film about? How can one represent states of mind that we are, hypothetically, at least, very unfamiliar with? How does one represent on film serious neurological impairment or serious psychopathology? How can one represent on film the absence of what we all take for granted as part of our ordinary lives and existence? How can one show that on film? Here I think we already have already just in this opening, amazing opening sequence, we already have the glimmerings of an answer. Yeah? You've got to somehow place the viewers, you've got to somehow place the audience in a position that radically unworlds them, that radically brackets their normal expectations, their normal experience, what they can normally take for granted, what you can normally take for granted. In particular, if part of what one is seeking to represent is part of what the point of view that one is wanting to make present to one's viewers actually involves an experience of radical confusion, well then it might be just as well to radically confuse the audience, to place them in a position where their expectations are actually confounded and turned on their heads, and they actually go through the experience of realizing that what they thought they could take for granted is not something they can take for granted, and now they don't really know what's going on. You don't really know what's going on. So you start watching the film, and you assume, in those first few frames, you just assume, of course you assume, that you are seeing something happening. Yeah? That you are seeing, in particular, a photograph develop, become more clear. That you are seeing somebody getting, as it happens, this is what it is for a photograph like this to develop, getting clearer about something that happened in the past. But then you start to realize, and at a certain moment realize very quickly, that this is not the case, that actually you're getting less clear about what happened in the past. Because you're moving into the past, the film is rolling backwards. It's incredibly simple, but an incredibly effective device. And once you get clear about that, so now you've learned something, you know something about what your condition is as the viewer of this film. And you can remember that. And you should remember that point. Because not everyone can. But nevertheless, you continue to be placed in a position of confusion, significant uncertainty. And there's more that we could say about this. You get to be placed in something like the very position of the narrator, the protagonist in this film. Yeah. How do you make a film about neurological impairment? How do you make a film about psychopathology? How do you make a film somewhat similar question about dreams. We'll come on to that dreaming. We'll come on to this, obviously, more next week. Well, you do something like this. You find some way of, in a quite subtle and sophisticated way, something along the lines of what I just indicated briefly, and that we also explore, obviously, in the essay by myself and Phil Hutchinson that you've read. Place your viewer in a position such that they inevitably have something profoundly in common with the very protagonist whose experience you're trying to represent. And that's how you get to start to identify them with them, not just as an other, but as something like yourself, or to put it the other way around, you get to place yourself in something like their position in a way that you never normally do. And in that way you get to identify with them. Any thoughts about this? Any questions or comments? So if we're interested, as we are in philosophy, in the nature of experiencing how we get to know things, in what it is to be in time, one of the ways in which we can come to understand something about that is by coming to have certain aspects of it that normally are completely taken for granted, so you can't, as it were, see them. They're like spectacles that you wear that you never dream of taking off. Now you take them off, you have great difficulty seeing in the normal way or in a certain sense at all anymore. And now you know something more about what it was to inhabit the normal position, which before you couldn't see because you saw through it, as it were. And you also know something about what it is to inhabit the non-normal position. Perhaps you know something about what it's like to inhabit the position of somebody who is some kind of skeptic. So, for example, memory skepticism in the history of philosophy. How do we really know anything about the past? Do we really know anything about the past? These can seem incredibly abstract questions that can never be asked seriously. But suddenly, with a film like this, one starts, does one not, to get into a position where one can start to ask them seriously. One can start to think, okay, well, yes, here's a kind of position that, a kind of perspective that could actually be inherited where those questions would seem serious. And moreover, now I'm getting vicariously to inhabit that position for a while. As the film goes on, right, one gradually figures out more and more of what is going on. And in that way, one is at an advantage compared to the protagonist. But then again, maybe one isn't at that much of an advantage compared to the protagonist, because he also figures out more of what's going on with his peculiar and fascinating method, which Phil and I discuss in our piece in some detail, as you will be aware. If you haven't read our piece yet, do read it after this class, and reread it if you've read it before. I would advise, as always, but please remember that we do expect in this class that you do recommended reading, compulsory reading rather, before each week, so I'm assuming you have read it. So, as Phil Hutchinson and I discuss in our piece in Film as Philosophy on Memento, we regard the film as a philosophical investigation, and the investigation that Leonard takes as making clear a certain kind of philosophical methodology and its problems. So you come to know more as the film proceeds. But then, and we'll look at this in a while, then as the film comes towards its end, or if you like, towards its beginning, once again, the knowledge that you have starts to get quite radically put into doubt. With Joe Pantoliano character's rewriting of the narrative, and with the way that brings out what should have been a occurring to you anyway, but which perhaps wasn't, and that Phil Hutchison and I dwell on at some length. But there's something very weird about this whole narrative. There's something that one isn't seeing, because perhaps one doesn't want to see it, about why, even as it starts gradually to make more and more sense, at some fundamental level, it doesn't make sense. I'll come to what that point is in a moment. But first let me say a tiny bit more about why one doesn't want to see it. Why doesn't one want to see that there's a problem with this narrative, with the story, if you like, that Leonard is telling us? I think the reason is that the identification process that one finds oneself in with regards to him makes one unwilling to consider the possibility that what is wrong with him, what is wrong about him, perhaps put it better, might be something other than what he is telling us and what we are learning. Why do I think that? Well, I think that one of the crucial things that happens in this narrative, and as one finds oneself undergoing this surprising process of identifying with somebody who A, is, as one knows from the start, from the end, a killer, and B, is ostensibly very different from oneself in that they have this neurological impairment. One's identification with Leonard, I want to suggest to you, becomes quite a strong kind of identification of, in Blade Runner type terms, empathy, and indeed a moral identification. One comes to think that there's something really kind of right about what he's trying to do. And his neurological impairment, which one gets to, his seeming neurological impairment, which one gets to experience alongside him, along with him, is something that leads one to be enormously sympathetic to him. And one feels sympathy for him by comparison with, and if you like, by contrast with the various other characters in the film. The film goes through this somewhat systematic journey with you as Leonard, but also with you as someone who is able to disidentify with Leonard and get more of a sense, more of an overview of what's going on, because you have a memory that you can develop gradually as the film goes on. With one character after another, one thinks something like, okay, well, maybe this is a good person or a decent person. Right? Maybe this is somebody who's going to help me, who's going to help poor Leonard, and who's got some kind of decency, some kind of goodness about them. And with one character after another, one is disappointed. This goes to the small characters like the motel clerk, and the main characters like Carrie Ann Moss and Joe Pantoliano, that one after another they turn out to be basically deceivers or users. I'm not saying this in a kind of one-dimensional way. I don't think they're one-dimensional characters at all. I think they're very brilliantly portrayed. And there are some extremely powerful moments of caring or at least decency between the various characters. I'm thinking particularly, for example, of the extraordinary scenes where Carrie Ann Moss is intensely intimate with Guy Pearce, despite the fact that he's murdered her boyfriend. She manages somehow to overcome her sense of anger against him to some degree. Partly, I think, because she, in a kind of Lockean-type way, thinks that if he can't remember things, then he really isn't responsible for his actions.
I don't think Ashley ever knows that Leonard killed Jimmy.
I think she strongly suspects.
Then why not accuse him?
Because I think she thinks it's pointless to accuse him, because he doesn't know that he did it.
Well, open question.
Yeah.
I would say Ashley does not know that Leonard killed Jimmy. She knows Jimmy went off to meet some guy called Teddy, and he never came back. Okay, Leonard turned up in a car, which is similar,
the same
as Jimmy, but that doesn't
actually, she doesn't. I think you're crucially right. She doesn't know. But I would claim she does strongly suspect. Does anyone have any views on this plot issue?
I think it's sort of. She doesn't. She, as you say, it's. She doesn't know, but it's. I think that she can't. She feels she can't hold him responsible.
Yeah.
And she. I think she realizes that the only way he'd get into a position where he could murder her boyfriend would be if someone was stringing along, as it were, which is seeing away what Teddy was doing. So I think she sort of, although she's obviously angry at him to an extent because he's complicit, and she probably thinks he's complicit in the murder, but she doesn't think that he's actually responsible for it, and that's why, in part, I think she helps him go after Teddy.
Yeah, and there's this kind of titanic struggle going on, as it were, off screen between Carrie Ann Moss and Joe Pantoliano, which is quite fascinating to watch. So, one character after another, one has hopes for them as the person who is going to do the decent thing by this man in this pitiable situation. And one after another, they disappoint one. And so by the time you reach the end of the film, you're essentially alone, right? There's the only character in whom hope can now be vested is Leonard himself. And this is, I think, the real reason why one doesn't want to consider the possibility that there's something going on other than what he tells us, other than what he seems, that one has learned, as it were, through one's vicarious first-person experience, is the reality of him. And this is, I think, this is very like the way that we struggle with problems in philosophy. According to a philosopher like Nietzsche or like Wittgenstein, philosophical problems seem to have the character of intellectual problems. Right? They seem to be like, they seem to require really hard thinking. They seem to require one to be clever. And this isn't exactly wrong, but it's a kind of superficial explanation. When it really comes down to it, philosophy is not about cleverness. Philosophy is about the willingness to really open your eyes, as film after film in this semester that we're looking at asks us to open our eyes, to really open your eyes and see the things that you don't want to see. Not that you're not clever enough to see, but that you don't want to see. The things that go against the grain of your education or go against the grain of culture. The things that if you did see them, you would have to radically reassess things that you don't want to radically assess. And it's the capacity to overcome those kinds of what Wittgenstein calls resistances of the will. And here Wittgenstein is modeling himself somewhat on Freud and thinking that a philosophical investigation is like a psychotherapeutic investigation, and the most difficult thing is not to remember your childhood or to figure out who exactly you feel angry against or whatever. The most difficult thing is to see the things about yourself and for that matter about other people that you don't want to see and to be able to accept those things, accept that they are there, and then perhaps be able as a result of that to overcome them and to actually change them, to actually change things. That I think is the real difficulty of philosophy. And I suggest that we find that difficulty here in the way that we are, at the end of the film, forced to acknowledge something that should have been staring us in the face throughout it, that there is something that doesn't add up about Leonard. And what that something is can, of course, be summed up in the following question. How does he know that he has this condition? How does he know that he has this condition? Isn't the knowledge that he has of the condition that he's in, which is a knowledge that, of course, you have as you watch, but supposedly not a knowledge that he has or could possibly have, isn't that knowledge the clue that as it were, the real detective, the real philosophical detective in us, should be looking out for, shouts out through all of the complexity and the subtlety of his narrative, that there's something very fishy about this whole thing, and suggests to us that something different is going on, and that maybe he isn't actually this kind of passive, non-responsible victim, but something very different from that, along the lines of what Phil and I lay out in our piece as a suggested interpretation of what is actually going on with him. And this is so unpleasant or unattractive a possibility, because it takes away the one thing that we had left to hold on to, which is that our narrator, our protagonist, the one whose voice we hear, the one whose perspective we are placed vicariously in this film, is actually not a victim, and is actually not somebody who deserves the kind of sympathy we've been giving him. And it's not the kind of one clear, decent, moral voice that we can hang on to, but is in fact, in a certain sense, a deceiver like all the others. Only, unlike the others, his principal deceit is practiced with regard to himself. He's in some kind of radical bad faith, some kind of radical denial of his own nature and of the past, presumably based, and we get a sense of this in the wonderful images that we'll see in a little while, that flash up as kind of alternative possible memories, presumably based on the possibility that there's something about his past that he's so unwilling to accept or to face that he has to basically invent this vast story to himself and believe it, about how he isn't the kind of person who he actually is. And that, as you'll be aware, is at the nub of the interpretation plot-wise that Phil Hutchinson and I have to offer. Any comments or questions about that, or about what I've said there? Yeah? Right, is your basic suggestion. This is a film about ideas. That's very clearly what Phil and I are arguing. And as you say, if our interpretation is along the right lines, then one of the things that this film is about the extreme power that an idea that one gets fixatedly attached to can have in terms of affecting one's entire experience in the course of one's life. It's a kind of more extreme example of the kind of thing that many philosophers, such as, for example, John Paul Sartre and the existentialist philosophers, who some of you will know, are interested in. The way that one can live one's whole life by an idea, indeed even if one is in a certain sense unaware of it, and perhaps even more so if one is in a certain sense unaware of it. In terms of your suggested kind of connection to Inception, I think that's right as well. And one of the things I would strongly encourage you all to do as you watch Inception and think about that over the coming week or so, is to think about Inception as a kind of, this is put it too strongly, but it's almost like it's a kind of remake of Memento, in my view. Or it's a kind of examination of the same themes through a different set of examples. Or if you want to use a musical kind of metaphor, it's like Memento is the theme and Inception is a set of variations on that theme. So yes, I think that this film is very much about the power of ideas. And one of the ways in which it's about the power of ideas, again, is that one doesn't necessarily want to see this. One doesn't necessarily want to see how this film is a film about the power of ideas. But that not wanting to see is itself an idea. It's an idea that one has, as I claim, to work through and to recognize and to acknowledge and to overcome. And again, I want to say, this is philosophy. This is real philosophy. That's what real philosophy is like. It's not real philosophy is not just like, oh, is this a valid argument, or what's your theory about such and such. The real philosophy is something more serious and more difficult than that. It's about being able and willing to look at and to see the things that you don't want to see, the things that are so difficult to see because they're before your very eyes all the time, or because if you did see them, you would actually have to change something. And we don't usually like changing things, especially about ourselves. Christoph.
I was thinking about, can we rephrase this whole self deception issue in Freudian terms? And one thing is, for me, it was a kind of Oedipal story, a rephrasing of the story of King Oedipus. I mean, he is investigating himself. And in the second Freudian term, maybe, can be the killing of the father, and in the second sense, the killing of the therapist.
The killing of?
The therapist.
Alright.
If it's like, I'm being sure, but I was just wondering if it's not.
Yeah, the killing of the therapist. Yeah, because I guess in the terribly sad and twisted situation in which Leonard finds himself, I suppose you'd have to say that Teddy is about the closest he has to a therapist. Yeah, that seems a good point. So yes, I like that. By the way, if you're thinking about the therapist on screen. We would again have to think in the context of what we're looking at this semester of Hannibal Lecter, and I think that the Lecter figure in The Silence of the Lambs is a fascinating sort of demonic sort of therapist figure, and one of the things that's worth considering is okay, so what works in that and what can be removed to make way for a version of the therapist which would not be demonic, which is hopefully what we might find in psychoanalysis or in Wittgensteinian or Nietzschean philosophy. So yeah, I think that's a really good thought. Thank you, Christoph. Vincent? Oh, you're just scratching your ears. Sorry, right. Yeah, good. Anybody else? Jerry? Oh, you just showed your chin.
I think that the film is philosophically interesting for a number of reasons. One is it sets up a challenge to some of the views we've already been looking at. You will remember. I'll start sentences if you will remember because I'm no longer alive. But if you remember, you had extracts from Locke available to you when you were studying Blade Runner, and this idea of the person as a special moral category that's a being created out of psychological statements, it's a being of memories essentially, and then there was the worry about the replicants who are beings like us, and they seem to have a combination, they have their own memories of their very short lives, but some of them also have other people's memories. And you start to worry whether they've met Locke's criteria of being a person. But that criteria is made out of what you know. In a sense, you are what you know, or you are what you remember. What Leonard seems to be is philosophical challenge to that from another direction, Schopenhauer wants to say, you remember Schopenhauer? Not you aren't what you know so much as you are what you do. So that if you don't know anything anymore, if you have this memory problem, you can still be a person. What's holding you together is not your chains of knowledge anymore, it's the chains of intention. So somebody in that position, and that's kind of clear, I think if you read the short story on which this film was based, that the narrator there is slightly less problematic, first person narrator, but memento mori. If you don't have any knowledge, then you can somehow sew all the pieces of your life together through will. That is this deliberate willing at every stage of his life, and like I said, every waking moment, the very least we've seen that's hold, somehow holding Leonard together. Leonard is not a creature who knows, he's a creature who wills. That's why you can't take his quest away from him. The quest isn't. Taking his quest away from him would be like taking his back from him. You collapse. And yet he has very strong conservative views about philosophy. He insists, he's a realist about the world, he's a Cartesian realist about the world. Yeah. There are facts that the world is what goes on even when you're not paying attention to it. And there are facts, and the facts are all that matter. The facts are real, the facts are clear and determinant. So clear, I can't think of all over the world. He says all those, does he believe
that? Sir?
Does he believe that? That facts are real and unchanging?
Well, isn't it an issue that he may or may not believe it, but isn't it more important that he has to believe it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say that he maybe doesn't believe that, just the scene at the end, where it's going to make himself forget, it's going to make himself change as well. And then he kind of makes himself forget about the fact that he's not, or we don't know if he does or not, makes himself forget about the fact that he knows what he's done to him, and he's told him.
Yeah, it's more complicated than that, though, isn't it? Because on the one hand, he makes sure that he doesn't forget what Teddy's done to him, so that he can take his revenge. But on the other hand, at this level now, which comes in with the interpretation that I'm seeking to offer, it looks like he does actually somehow kind of will himself to forget, such that he can engage in this whole complicated process of revenge. And I think what Jerry's saying is absolutely right. There's something, I used the word demonic a few minutes ago, there's something kind of demonic about Leonard's will, and the way that he is absolutely determined to kind of embrace certain philosophical positions, and to refuse to face certain other things about himself. And in this way, it seems to me he's a very intriguing, but actually sort of very kind of disturbing and ultimately sort of undesirable model of what a philosopher might be. So I think we can counterpose this kind of almost demonic will that runs through him with the idea that I'm suggesting, that what philosophy really is about overcoming the resistances that one's will offers to what one ought to do. And that's what he completely fails to do. And that's the sense in which I want to say that as the film goes on, you lose kind of one thought after another, and all you have left to hold on to is your sense of poor Leonard and your identification with him. And then that too is pulled away from under you. And in a certain sense, you're left with nothing. And in that sense, this film is one of the most resolutely negative films that we're going to watch this entire semester, I think. More negative than any other, I would say, with the exception of the last year at Marienbad. More negative even than the very difficult films which we'll watch later, like Never Let Me Go and Melancholia. That you're kind of left with virtually nothing whatsoever positive hold on to. But of course, the real point here, and we'll see this again, as I say, in a few minutes' time when we watch the end of the film, after we take a short break, the whole point is that you're still actually left with yourself. Right? And you don't have to follow Leonard down the path that he took. And there are these little hints, I think, towards the end of the film about what that alternative route that you could take that would be very different from him, a more positive route, about what that would look like, and I'll point those out. I mentioned them briefly in the article. Jerry, was there more you wanted to add to what you said there? Or was that basically it? Yeah.
You mentioned the props that we lose over the course, and I think there's an interesting idea that runs through the film of embodiment, and it comes up in Inception as well. Obviously we have the embodiment, and that Leonard is trying to embody his facts of his body. But there's also, I think, the objects he has that belong to his wife. When he hires the escort, asks her to put them around the room, he's trying to recreate this semblance of what it was like with his wife as an attempt to break from it, and then he burns them. He's trying to remove his association with the past, with something that is painful, by destroying objects that remind him, and yet at the same time, as he says, can't remember to forget you. And we'll see in Inception also they have, of the various characters, they have things they call totems, which are reminders of their reality. But what we see here is Leonard's attempt to divorce himself from his association with his wife. It doesn't work. And why would he be trying to do that when he's also trying to avenge her? So we have, I think, this weird tension in Leonard's actual embodied life, that, as Jerry said, his quest is his life. He's more a human doing than a human being. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, he's trying to get away from them with these physical, but physical objects. But how much of what we understand of memory and identity is bound up with the objects around us? Doesn't really give us an answer there, because then it doesn't really, in that respect, know what he's doing.
Well, there's a worry with this notion of an attack, and Leonard sort of really believes that an attack is something that's fixed and determinate, and has a determinate meaning. I suppose you might want to say it's an atomic attack, which is a bigger sense. What seems to be clear as the film progresses towards the end is that this is completely untrue. But the individual facts he has have no meaning at all outside the context. And if the context changes, then the fact changes. The apparent meaning of the photograph near the beginning, stroke end of the film, is very different from the meaning you get when you look at that photograph towards the end, beginning of the film. The facts change their meanings all the way through, depending on the context they're in. What was a fact at one point is very different. Nothing Leonard can do can affect that. Even by writing, he has a photograph, that has a meaning. That's not enough. He writes on the photograph. He writes more on the photograph. He can never make a determinate fact, because the fact only has meaning within the context where it originated, and as it drifts through Leonard's life, so it changes into meaning. Tattooing it on his body is not helping. You still want to wake up in the morning and say, why have I got SG-13-7IU tattooed on my thigh?
In the sense, it's something like, in kind of the way that Phil and I talk about it, it's something like a critique of various very influential theories of meaning and of language and of representation in philosophy. You can see it, for example, as a critique of empiricism, of some kind of idea that these tokens of experience or facts stand by themselves to be added up into a correct factual picture of what's going on. And arguably this is just a complete misunderstanding.
In terms of reassessing what we see, when thinking of the scene when Natalie comes back to see Leonard and tells him the dog has come, and that she says repeatedly, you beat the shit out of me, you see her reprints, like, okay, she's been beaten up. And then we see what happened before and realise it was Leonard to beat her up. The context clearly changes. The fact remains Natalie's been beaten up. But who did it? The context is completely altered. And we have this from our perception. But I think that's an useful instance of what Jerry was just saying, that what we know is entirely dependent on its context.
Yeah. Again, to explicate what I mean by saying that I think that Leonard is, in a tragic way, trapped in the past, but not in the way that we take it for most of the film that he is. He seems to be trapped in the past in the sense that can't make new memories, allegedly, and he is stuck remembering his wife, etc., etc. He wants to forget her. I think he's actually trapped by a sense of vengeance and the demonic will that he has, that he makes his life because he doesn't want to look at the reality of the past. The reality of the past, perhaps, that his wife left him. We don't know. But there's something in his past that he's so determined not to look at that he builds this gigantic alternative reality on the top of it. And this is obviously something that will be in a different way revisited in Inception. Right, let us take a 10-minute break, 10 minutes sharp, then we will resume.
I think my
Okay, so let's restart. So what I want to do now, as promised, is to watch the end of the film with you. We're not going to watch the entire end of it, if you see what I mean. But we'll watch quite a bit of it. I'll follow through this crucial section where we haven't already realize that something funny is going on, although arguably it's not stated in the film just how funny it is. To put the context for this, I want to just read out, if I may, the closing passages of the article by Phil and me. So if you've got the book and you want to follow this, this is page 89 of Film as Philosophy. So about 10 lines down from the top. Leonard has caught himself in a huge, awful and useful web of deception. His, quote, condition, unquote, leaves him terribly vulnerable to others' manipulations, and he experiences almost nothing but such manipulations in the course of the action of Memento. But in effect, he takes this to be worth it. His tragic position is less bad for him, as it were, as he feels it, even though this isn't actually the case, than the alternative, facing up to what has happened to him, to what he has done, and to what he's made himself into. And this is the part I really want to draw your attention to. This is part of what I want you to watch as the very end of the film approaches. Rather than maintain himself in such a constant state of anxious and delusional denial, Leonard could take a different route. The therapy offered by the film itself to its viewer, which is somewhat like the therapy offered by the entirety of Lichtenstein's text to his reader, is, we think, encapsulated in the beautiful motion of the camera as Leonard's car swings into and out of the yard of the abandoned building where the film starts and ends, and by its curves he drives away into the future. Living in the present, which requires acknowledging but not being possessed by the past, as those who obsessively remember it or obsessively forget it are, would involve appreciating that beauty which is visible to us as viewers, if we're prepared to see it, but which Leonard cannot see, locked as he is into an obsessive inwardness of thought and a bizarre externalization of memory. This obsessive inwardness of thought, this kind of rumination, which he's completely caught up in, like a person who's extremely depressed, which is actually quite like the position that he takes up during a lot of these closing sequences, is, I think, extremely striking during these closing sequences. As the car curves away down the road, we are given a point of view shot for perhaps the first time in the film. We see the scene as Leonard sees it. It's beautiful, but he sees none of that. He has trapped himself in the present, which is the very contrary of living in the present. He sort of trapped himself in a chunk of the past in a falsified way, and in the now, in a way which is not kind of open to existence, open to seeing what is actually there. So that's part of what I want you to try to watch out for as we watch this final scene.
Great story is better every time you tell it. So you're lying to yourself to be happy. There's nothing wrong with that. We all do it. Who cares if there's a future if you feel you'd rather not remember? What the fuck are you talking about?
I don't know.
Your wife's surviving the assault, her not believing your condition, the torment and pain and anguish tearing her up inside. The insult.
Right. That's sin. I told you it's sin.
Yeah, right. Like you tell yourself over and over again, conditioning yourself to remember, learning through repetition.
Sam let his wife kill herself. Sam ended up in an institution.
And he was a con man, a faker.
Actually, Sam was faking.
Exposed for what he was, a fraud.
But I was wrong, that's the whole point. Sam's wife came to me.
Sam didn't have a wife. It was your wife who had diabetes.
Ouch. My wife was a pirate.
You sure? Ouch.
She was a diabetic. I think I don't know my own wife. What the fuck is wrong with you?
Well, I guess it only made you remember the things you wanted to. Like old Jimmy down there.
He's not the right guy.
He was to you. Come on, you got your revenge. Enjoy it while you still remember. What difference does it make whether he was your guy or not?
Man, makes all the difference.
Why? You never let it out. Why won't?
I will. Because I know.
You won't remember.
Next time, I don't know. It'll be different.
Well, I thought so too. In fact, I was sure of it, but you did it. That's right. The real Chan Chi. I helped you find him over a year ago. He's already dead.
Don't let me.
Look, Lenny. I was the cop assigned to your wife's case. I believed you. I thought you deserved a chance for revenge. I'm the one that helped you find the other guy in your bathroom that night. The guy that cracked your skull and fucked your wife. We found him. You killed him. But you didn't remember. So I helped you. Start looking again. Looking for the guy you already killed.
So who was he?
Just some guy. I mean, does it even matter who? No reason, Lenny. No conspiracy, just bad fucking luck. A couple of junkies too strung out to realize your wife didn't live alone. But when you killed him, I was so convinced that you remembered. But it didn't stick. Like, nothing ever sticks, like this won't stick. I took that picture. Just like you did. Look how happy you are. I want to see that face again.
Oh, gee, thanks.
Fuck you. I gave you a reason to live, and you were more than happy to help. You don't want the truth. You make up your own truth, like your police file. It was complete when I gave it to you. Who took out the 12 pages?
You.
No, it wasn't me. See, it was you.
Why did I do that?
To create a puzzle you could never solve. You know how many towns, how many John G's or James G's? I mean, shit, Lenny, I'm fucking John G.
Your name's Teddy.
My mother calls me Teddy. My name's John Edward Gamble. Cheer up. There's plenty of John G's for us to find. Oh, do it, Mom. I'm the one that has to live with what you've done. I'm the one that put it all together. You walk around and play detective? Live a dream, kid. A dead wife to pine for. A sense of purpose to your life. A romantic quest that you wouldn't have even if I wasn't in the picture.
She killed you.
Quit it, Lenny. Come on. You're not a killer.
That's why you're so good at it.
Come on, what are you doing? You know what time it is? It's 3 o'clock. I'm lying. Fuck.
I'm not a killer. I just don't want to do anything to hide. Can I see myself in what you told me?
Thank you.
That final line, you all need mirrors to remind ourselves who we are, and the wonderful reflections in the glass. It feels to me that it takes on a sort of a different meaning in having seen Manhunter. It's almost as if this is just another version of the same horrendous kind of enclosure within the self that Dolehide has in Manhunter, which leads him to want to replace other people's eyes with mirrors so that he can see himself and his wonderfulness. And by this point, you have to make a decision about whether you think that Leonard is a character who one can continue to sympathize with and to see as a kind of a victim or a person sort of trying to do the right thing or not. And my argument is that one ought to go for the not option. And that the alternative possibility is not posed by any character in the film at all, but is posed, if at all, by yourself and by the way that those final, very final shots are filmed, giving you some kind of sense of what it would be to see and to be, to live in the present. But this is just what Leonard is unwilling to do. Instead, he is stuck in this kind of fabricated past, and we start to see how it is fabricated as we see these visions of perhaps what really happened breaking through in these images we see of his wife. Or maybe they're not visions of what really happened, but of kind of alternative versions of reality which he himself is fabricating. And in this future that he is determined to create, that he is again, in a certain sense, fabricated. And an unwillingness or an inability, but I think it's more like an unwillingness to actually be present to what is actually happening and to accept the reality of what did happen before. Any thoughts about that or any questions? So it's a desperately, desperately sad film, I think that's right. But I think it would be a mistake to get sort of consumed by its sadness or negativity. It offers you, I think, towards the very end there, a kind of a clue or a set of clues which you can be the detective for and investigate and turn into something worthwhile about what the alternative might be. About what it would be like not to be consumed, not to be caught up in this continual chain of kind of ruminations in the way that in perhaps the worst sense philosophers are sometimes alienated from the world and from reality by being caught up in a set of thoughts, in a logic which takes them away from reality rather than bringing them into contact with it. Vincent or Jerry, anything you want to add or say at this point?
Well, something to do maybe with considering linking Memento in with Manhunter and Blade Runner, but this is something I mentioned yesterday, that they're all detective tales, and Jerry commented that what Leonard does is intrinsically, it's what he's doing, detecting, is intrinsically linked to his sense of self and embodiment. Now, what this question is, I think we've talked about last week in relation to Manhunter as well, what sort of problems does this create if one's entire sense of self-identity is entirely bound up in the sense of detecting? It does perhaps present this, means one's constantly performing an investigation, but in the case of Leonard, there's somebody who takes it too far and decides that everything he has to be investigated, but can you actually trust what you find out when you investigate it. His detection is supposed to be the accumulation of knowledge, but to what extent does Memento problematize these ideas of, as you investigate, you learn, you acquire knowledge? Then it says at one point, the memory is a fact, it's an interpretation. Well, isn't his whole investigation ultimately an interpretation anyway?
Yes, isn't it as though, again, it's quite similar to what often happens in philosophy. One might think of Cartesian methods, for example, or a phenomenological method. That one, in philosophy, often brackets a whole load of things. One says, well, look, we're going to really know if we put a whole lot of things that we're not 100% sure of into question. If we don't rely on those things, and we only rely on things that we can really know. And that's something like what Leonard, as you just said, says. So one question would be, well, is that actually the secure path to knowledge? Or is that a kind of guarantee of a kind of lack of knowledge? Does that prevent one from having the kind of ordinary knowledge that one actually is entitled to, even if it doesn't meet certain kind of artificial theoretical thresholds of what knowledge would be?
Is all knowledge ultimately subjective? The old cliche of the true wisdom is the only true knowledge is to know that you know nothing. Learner's not prepared to accept that he knows nothing. He insists that he knows X, Y, and Z, and then everything he finds out is certain knowledge, at least some of the time.
But has he already bracketed too much to be able to even be sure of X, Y, and Z? And that seems to be something like the position that he then starts to get into at the very end of the film. Jerry? You stood up in a sort of meaningful way.
Yeah, I have to stand up to think. Sorry.
Ah, right.
One thought that occurred to me about this notion of knowledge was this distinction between knowledge as written knowledge and knowledge as recorded knowledge. All the films we've looked at so far have made a good deal out of pictures. Blade Runner is full of photographs, some of which get analysed in plausible detail. Manhunter is solved by films, by careful analytical analysis of other movies.
And Greg carries photographs of the families as well.
Mm-hmm. And here we have photographs. Or at the very end here, we don't have photographs. Where two photographs are deliberately burned by language to get rid of the evidence, is that right? Almost a sort of curious belief that with a strong enough will, the written word can overcome the photograph. We burn the photographs, we write the word, or the number in here, the license plate number, that the written word is in some way dominant. You can write it down, it's a fact. I'm still not quite sure what to make of that.
Well, it's a common thing. It's interesting that, of course, Leonard is a different sort of detective to Graham Deckard, because he's not a police detective or even a private detective. He used to be in insurance. Now, I work in insurance, and not as a claims investigator, admittedly. But something which does come up a lot is, in any sort of business situation, people want things in writing. They want things written down because this makes them factual. And when it comes to insurance claims, statements are taken, but also there's a whole thing about diagrams. But as we see here, what is written down or what is photographed is only as good as the person who's writing it down. It's only as reliable as those who take a picture. And in relation to how this works in the filmic medium, the camera angle, what we see is only as reliable and as convincing as the camera angle where it's positioned. Some people complain that they don't like films manipulating them. Well, in that case, they don't watch films at all because they're always manipulating you. The fact that Memento runs backwards is entirely an act of manipulation.
Yes, although of course it's important that it's an act that becomes visible to one. So I think the question vis-à-vis manipulation is do films seek to manipulate in a way that they try to keep concealed from you, to not make focal? And I think that, for example, some of the films of Oliver Stone or Steven Spielberg can be criticized for doing that, and also more kind of popular and not very good films often can be criticized for doing that, manipulating emotions and so on. Or do films manipulate in such a way that the manipulation itself becomes something which can in turn empower the attentive viewer? And that's what I think is typically the pattern in the films that we're watching this semester. I think it's certainly the pattern in Memento. And this is a very important distinction, because it's the distinction between films as, if you like, devices of entrapment and manipulation, or films as devices which can lead you to a greater autonomy, that can have a transformative effect, in that you can, if the film kind of works with you, if you like, if you view it in the right way, to free you from the way in which it and other things manipulate or constrain you. And this is, I think, one of the essential ways in which I would like to claim that the vast majority, at least, of the films that we're watching this semester act as agents of freedom and of transformation. An interesting case in point will be last year at Marienbad, which I already mentioned before the break, which many of you won't have seen before. You will definitely be reminded of Memento at times when you watch last year at Marienbad, which has this whole thing running through it more explicitly than Memento does until near the end of Memento, about showing you kind of alternative versions of the past and putting into question whether the narrator is reliable or not in the most explicit way imaginable. One of the ways in which this happens in last year at Marienbad, again, sort of like Memento writ large, as you will see, is that the narration, the words, and the images start to kind of diverge. It's almost as if you're starting to get two different films, one which are being shown, and the other one where a voice is trying to say, no, something different was happening. And in last year at Marienbad, unlike in Memento, the voice at a certain point actually starts saying, no, the images are wrong. It actually makes it extremely explicit in that way. So yeah, that would be my thought about how this question of manipulation, which is extremely important, plays into some of these films that we're watching at the moment.
Particularly in Memento, the fact that we get sort of exposed to us,
yeah.
And that Leonard is manipulating himself. A very good point that was made during the break was that related to the tattoo he has on his chest, which is backwards. John G. Raped and Murdered My Wife. So that can only be read when he looks in the mirror. So by doing that, Leonard is pre-manipulating what the image will be when he sees it, in order to ensure that when he looks in the mirror, he will see what he's already decided he wants to see. So there we see his manipulation exposed, and over the course of the film, of course, we come to see that he's been manipulating himself for however long this has been, over a year ago, Teddy, just as much as Teddy and Natalie manipulate him, he manipulates himself, and in doing so, this kind of exposes to us, the viewer, the ways in which the film can manipulate us, but offer us an alternative, which Leonard doesn't take, but perhaps we can.
Yes.
Which is how the film, I think, works therapeutically.
Yeah, I think that's right. And of course, what Phil Hutchinson and I try to argue is that there's even one further twist of the screw that more or less undiscussed by the film, or if you like, in the film, is this question of whether there's a deeper manipulation still going on that Leonard is doing. How does he know that this is fact number six? How does he know that he has this condition, etc.? Is there another possibility which would more plausibly explain the entirety of what's going on? A sense in which even more than Teddy explicitly says, he's a con man, he's constructing the whole thing. This would have to be a sense in which he's conning himself. The same kind of dynamic applies in Inception. One of the things that you need to do when you're watching Inception is to keep seeking to figure out how what you're seeing could be possible, and to notice some of the ways in which the ostensible plot lines are problematic, and try to notice not just the way that the film is manipulating you and the way that the film is exposing to you its own manipulations for understanding, but the way that, if you like, you're manipulating yourself. Right? And this is what I want to say again. It's a thing which is really hard to do, to see the things that you don't want to see. This is, I think, the real challenge that a film like Memento or Inception brings to one. Are there ways in which you kind of want to go along with the idea, for example, that it's all a dream, or it's still a dream at the end, or various other kinds of attractive ideas? And why would you want to think that? The thing that the perspective that you are inclined to take on the film, try to put that into question and wonder about why that is a perspective that seems natural to you. And that's the way you'll get the most deep philosophical rewards from it. One final thing about this film, just very briefly. I've made this claim that virtually all really good philosophical films have really good titles. What do you make of the title of this film? What do you understand by Memento? Why does this work if it works as a title? Yeah?
Well, it probably works on many different levels. On one level, it's the idea of having something to remember, something by, like, oh, I took this memento from my trip to Paris so that I can remember my trip to Paris more.
Good.
So I have something to anchor my memories to.
Yeah.
Which, of course, Leonard does a lot, but of course he manipulates these objects in ways that suit him, or he wants, or he needs.
Yeah. So good. So this is the totem point again. Now, I mean, it's interesting that you said this trip to Paris.
Which I was just thinking.
But I think that's kind of revealing. So Paris is this kind of wonderful, lovely place with great architecture that we go to in Inception, for example. Paris is this kind of classic kind of tourist destination. The word memento, doesn't it precisely kind of conjure up in our memories or in our imaginations ideas of places like that which are kind of meaningful to us, but actually in a certain sense quite sort of trivial. Right? They're actually not the most important things in our life. Right? If you ask what's the most important things in your life, it's going to be maybe things like what you really believe in, or the people you're very closest to, the people you love, the things you're most proud of, the things you're most ashamed of. It's not almost certainly going to be where you went on holiday last year, like even with your lover or whatever. Right? What I'm getting at is, isn't there something wonderfully sort of trivializing in this word memento? Right? Oh yes, I've got a little memento, I've got a little knick-knack from my trip. As I see it, the memento as the title for the film is a kind of provocation, really. Right? It's trying to say, so we're led to think that these pictures and objects that Leonard has are deeply, deeply significant to him. And in a way, they obviously are, and in that way, they stand in stark contrast to this sort of trivial knick-knack type interpretation of the term memento. But perhaps at a deeper level, there's something that the two have in common. Right? Perhaps there's some way in which these photos and these objects are a kind of a blind. Perhaps they're actually standing in the way of, once again, of our recognizing what's really happening here. Of the way in which, as we heard it earlier, perhaps this film isn't really a film about objects and their significance. Perhaps it's more a film about the power of ideas, which invests certain objects with enormous significance, perhaps even when they don't really have that significance. Right? you can create and force yourself to believe in a kind of false past if you invest certain objects with huge significance, if you manage to engage in an operation of denial with regard to yourself such that you fool yourself into thinking that these objects have this huge significance, which is actually something that you've imposed upon them. So I'm not sure about that. That's kind of a process of thought which may or may not be right, but it seems to me that it may capture something kind of, if you like, deeply significant about this title, yeah?
There's a level at which, if we view like pictures that mementos, EPs, and we view them, as you say, as a sort of knick-knack. Normally, we understand mementos as something just a little knick-knack. He's actually using these things that are relatively minor, and he's using them to, in a way, govern his entire purpose in life.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a commentary on overvaluing these very minor things and manipulating himself to certain ends with these things and using them to deny the truth, in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good, thank you. Okay, so that's memento, but we'll stay with memento when we do exception. You had the masterclasses last week, and they'll be next week also, but this week it's seminar, so remember to go to your seminar, and that's it basically. See you at the workshop. Cheers.